Our series on the Sermon on the Mount, Who is in the Mirror? And I want you to look at this Facebook post that someone sent me just the other day. This is a cousin of mine. I've referred to him. He is an atheist, and we have a fair bit of contact. An atheist believes that a hospital should be built instead of a church. An atheist believes that a deed must be done instead of a prayer said. An atheist strives for involvement in life and not escape into death. He wants disease conquered, poverty banished, war eliminated. A hospital should be built instead of a church. More than atheists that critique the church today, these are all quotes from evangelical Christians. Someone has said, church has now become a refuge from the world, a Christian club exhausted by trying to keep its members happy. Someone has said, the evangelical church in North America exists for itself. Someone else said, the church's inward focus is a great illness. When we think of the Church Universal, Byron Community Church, as a specific local church, as we think of a church made up of individuals, the question I ask is, would we be missed if Byron Community Church was no longer in this community? Would there be a sense of sadness? Would there be neighbors? Would there be people around us going, oh no, that church is moving locations? Would we be missed? Hey, would you be missed if you moved to another neighborhood? Would people be going, can we go on without that kind of person and that family in our neighborhood? What about your workplace? If you were transferring to another school or another store, Would you be missed? Would people go, oh, that person was so valuable in this setting? The question we have today has to do with the impact and effectiveness of our church. Is Jesus' intention that we as a church be a club? That you as a personal believer be a person who's kind of isolated from others? What does Jesus intend for you and me? Well, today's title is Salt and Light, the Salt and Light Company. And I've called this a community, individuals of irresistible influence. And a quick formula for you, irresistible influence means maximum impact. If we're going to have impact in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, in our homes, as a church, if we're going to have impact, it's about irresistible influence. It's this kind of influence that's needed in our neighborhoods. It's needed in our communities. It's needed here in London. It's needed in Canada. Irresistible influence is what we need to provide for our world. Just a quick recap. We have been in the Sermon on the Mount. We spent our first two Sundays looking at Jesus as he begins to teach the multitudes on a mountainside. He's primarily directing his comments to his followers, to his would-be followers, and he comes up with a list of 8 characteristics of a follower of Christ. These 8 marks are what we should strive for. It's the kind of marks and characters that God approves of. So we looked at some characteristics, like we're to be poor in spirit, humbly dependent on God. We are to be sad about our sin. We are to sorrow over our sins and the sins in this world. And then we went on with that list, and you can review that in the first few verses of Matthew chapter 5. Well, this morning, we move on in our study, and we're going to be looking at a very famous paragraph. Most of you have heard sermons on it before, but let's look now at Matthew 5, 13 to 16. So Jesus has just finished these Beatitudes, these eight blessings, and says, "Now you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." It would be interesting, as you think of these people on the mountainside, they were a motley group. They were all kinds of men and women. I'm going to guess that many of them were poor. Many of them were outsiders. We know from the last Beatitude that they had experienced persecution. They had been insulted. They had been slandered, and if they were asked at that point, now who is going to be, or what is going to have influence in the world, I'm sure they would have had some of the traditional responses and answers at that time. The temple will be a place of influence. The Torah, God's law. Maybe they were thinking of Jerusalem, the city, as being a city of great influence and impact. And I would guess a few of them would think, well, it would be the religious experts, the Pharisees. They're the ones who will have influence and impact around us. And I am sure that it jolted the crowds. It jolted Jesus' hearers when he said, "You are the salt. You are the light." I can just imagine someone elbowing the person beside them, saying, "Can you believe this? This is about us. This is about what we can do. This is about the impact we can have." They would have known, at least in a preliminary way, that salt, especially back then, impacts meat. That light impacts the darkness. But we're going to break that down. So let's look at what Jesus meant by "you are the salt of the earth." They were not far from the Dead Sea, which is known as having a great amount of salt. Even to this day, it's a very salty sea. And if you know anything about salt, I'm not a scientist, but salt is a major component is sodium chloride, which is a very strong compound. But especially then, it could be broken down. It could be insipid. It could have its potency taken away from it, and this is what I think Jesus is after when he's saying, "Make sure the salt doesn't lose its saltiness." But what does it mean when Jesus says, "You are the salt"? What is this metaphor about? There's usually been two or three possible explanations. I'll outline them for you, and then tell you why I think we need a blended approach, but there may be a primary meaning to "you are the salt." So when we think about salt, now in a negative sense, you and I know that sometimes we avoid salt, right? Because salt increases your blood pressure. So some of you are going, "Well, I'm not sure if I like that metaphor." But think of two or three other possible meanings of "you are the salt." One has to do with thirst. And salt stimulates thirst, doesn't it? So if you go to a bar, this is what I've heard, they will often serve salty peanuts and salty pretzels. They want to increase their sales and of beverages, and so they will serve that which is salty. And it's a stimulant in that way. And I think this is perhaps what Jesus it means by "you are the salt," that we're to stimulate spiritual thirst among those we deal with. Salt is also a spice. Can you imagine corn on the cob without salt? and butter, but for this purpose, we'll think of salt. So it spices things up. Or potato chips or French fries. I mean, can you imagine French fries without salt? But likely the primary meaning Jesus had, though I appreciate the other meanings, was back then especially salt was a preservative. It kept meat from rotting. It kept meat from spoiling. You did not have refrigerators back in the day where Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount. And what you would have to do with a piece of meat that you bought in the market, you would have to rub it down with salt. You'd likely purchase it that way, and you yourself might do what's necessary to preserve it. Now, someone has said, and I really appreciate this because I like to keep things simple, that in essence, being salt means that we enhance what is good. So fries are good, but even better when they have salt on them. So enhancing the good, and then when we think of the preservative feature, where it's stopping decay, we are halting what is bad. So did you get that? So you're the salt means that we are enhancing what is good, and being salt, the flip side means that we are halting what is bad. Some have said that Jesus here in verse 13 is keying in on social justice, and I think one could make a credible argument for that. What does it mean for you to enhance the good? You may be involved in a school that's a good school, and your presence makes it better. You may say, I live in a pretty decent neighborhood, but your presence, your very dealings with people make it an even better neighborhood. In the workplace, it's a pretty good workplace, but you make it even better. Just the way you are, the way you behave, the way you conduct yourself. I believe very strongly that there's attachment between the Beatitudes and this paragraph. And as we pursue the kind of character that Jesus wants us to develop, then we will be able to truly enhance those around us. I think of the sports fields. I think of the world in general. As Christians, we should be those who are enhancing what is good. There are good structures in place. There are good things that God has ordered in place for us. And our desire, our impact, should be to make what is good even better. But I think Jesus may primarily be looking at, as I said, with the idea of salt impacting meat, is that we halt what is bad. I don't know about you, but I was very inspired, Rick, with the report we heard last Sunday. In a general way, your visit to Ghana, but especially what IJM, International Justice Mission, is doing in Uganda. It bothered me when I heard that widows can have their land stolen. And there's IJM going in and making a difference. They're having impact in that country. I think it's a privilege that we know Rick and some others who work with IJM who are leading the way. We're partnering with them. And that's what I look at as halting what is bad. That is Christians being salt, halting what is bad in our society. I think of a little guy years ago in the British Parliament. They say he was so unimpressive looking that it was outrageous. In fact, he was often described as being elf-like. I don't think that's a compliment. He looked like an elf. But this little guy, when he got up to speak, when he asserted himself on social issues, had great impact. Maybe you've heard the name William Wilberforce. And he was the man who single-handedly led the way in stopping the slave trade. A great hero of our Christian faith. Or how about John Henry? I married John Henry and Diane years ago. Now I need to tell you, don't want to offend anyone, John Henry is Catholic. and one of the strongest believers in Jesus Christ I know. Over the years, we've had many interesting conversations about Christianity and what it means to be an evangelical Christian. But John Henry is a Canadian who is leading the way when it comes to the sanctity of life. And it's an issue that many of us are very passionate about. And he has audiences in North America. He is regularly at the Vatican and in many places of influence around the world. Now, can I say this? And again, I'm not wanting to offend. But while we can be critical of Catholics in many ways, Catholics have led the way when it comes to the abortion issue. And historically, as evangelicals, we have been late to the mark. Now, we have come on over the last years, but I am grateful for guys like John Henry. It's not popular today, is it, to speak out against abortion? Yet I know, can you imagine what it would be like in our world today if there weren't people speaking out against abortion? Can you imagine the extent of the downward spiral? And Jesus is saying, one of our purposes, one of the reasons we're here in the world is to be salt, is to halt the decay, to halt the sin and evil that's in our world today. I want to give an example that may be a little more down to earth in terms of practical day-to-day experience. I remember a few years ago, Mark had a coach in house league hockey. And she was a woman. And there were a lot of families that weren't thrilled that their young boys were being coached by a woman. And some were very vocal about it. And I remember in particular one family who were out to stir the pot. They were out to cause trouble. And I thought to myself, I really don't want to get involved. I want to stand on the sidelines to this issue. But then I decided, no, we have a role to play. And I remember talking to that family and a couple of other families saying, you know what? This is a good person. And she's very dedicated to the boys. She has some quirky coaching tactics. She'd pull the goalie at the start of the third period when we were behind by a goal. That's just not done in hockey, but I thought, good for her. She's wanting to be creative. And I had an opportunity then and there to halt something that was wrong. I know it's hard. You say, well, how am I to do that in the lunchroom? I mean, they're gossiping about this person. It's what we do in the lunchroom. Believe as a Christian, you are called to be salt. You are to halt the evil that is going on around you. And I believe that when we do that, we are then given opportunity to stimulate thirst. They may not respect you at first. They may slander you, go, here's this do-gooder. But it will have an impact eventually. Let me tell you another quick story before we move on. I, in high school, played football with a guy. His name was Tim. And Tim was a wild guy. Tim was the bad guy of our school. Good football player, but a bad guy. And Tim would tell us that he had this grandma who was rubbing him the wrong way. Now, I find that interesting because when we think of salt rubbed into something to preserve it, Tim would say, my grandma rubs me the wrong way. What do you mean by that, Tim? Well, she keeps praying for me and praying for me. And he said, what's this with this grandma of mine who prays? And if I go over for a visit, she'll put on a nice meal, but then she'll lecture me about what I'm doing and how I'm behaving, and it's driving me crazy. But you know what? Tim, towards the end of high school, hit rock bottom. And the great story is Tim became a believer in Jesus Christ. And Tim will tell you to this day that it was the influence, it was the impact of his grandma, who dared to rub him the wrong way, who dared to step up and say, I'm going to try to halt your decline into more wickedness. And Tim today, likely right now, is preaching a sermon at the church he pastors in Toronto. Little Pentecostal church right in the heart of Toronto. Isn't God good? Doesn't he work in wondrous way? But aren't you grateful for a grandma? And some of you go, well, I can't go to Uganda. I'm beyond being a crusader for some of these social issues. But in your way, in your sphere of life, you can influence. You can have an impact. And there is a warning here, isn't there, with the idea of salt, that if it loses its saltiness, if salt is not being used, if it's not useful, then it's all about as good as just throwing it out and stomping all over it. Imagine if you invited me to your place for dinner and you said, John, we're going to serve corn on the cob. I'd be quite excited. I like corn on the cob. And the butter's out and it's just ready to go. You can roll it in the butter. This is what the purpose of this bar of butter is. And then I look over and there's the pepper shaker and the salt shaker. And you say, well, no. It's a nice looking salt shaker. It's a beautiful ornament we got as a wedding gift, but we really don't use it. Go, you don't use the salt shaker? No, it's just an ornament. I go, well, what good is a salt shaker if you can't pour salt out of it? Right? Do you agree with me? Well, Jesus is saying, what good is a Christian if he's not being poured out into the world? What good is a Christian if he's taking refuge in the church and never rubbing shoulders with people in the world? Or have you ever had the experience with salt where, and I'm not going to use the technical words, but it kind of crystallizes, it lumps together. And when you do manage to get it out of the salt shaker, it's generally quite ineffective. It's lost its saltiness. So if you're not pursuing the Beatitudes, if you're not pursuing Christ-like character, what is it that you have to offer the world? It's as we develop Christ-likeness, as we allow Christ to work in and through us, that we have the potential of having great impact in our world. Let's look again at the second metaphor. I'm not going to read it again, but you can follow the words of the scriptures there behind me. Just interesting enough, when I was working on this section of the sermon, how ironic, the power went out. I was at our home on Friday afternoon. I was working, and all of a sudden, as I got to You Are the Light, the power went out. And I thought, wow, we do need light, don't we? But Jesus says to them and to us, you are the light of the world. In Isaiah 49 and other places in the Old Testament, there's this idea of the Jewish people being a world-saving light. And Jesus adopts this and applies it to himself. You remember in John 8, at the Festival of Lights, where he says, I am the light of the world. Great statement. But make no mistake about it, Jesus now is turning to these early followers of him and saying, you are the light. You are the light of the world. Like a city on a hill. Do you know how it is when you've been on a trip on the airplane and you're descending into Toronto and you see all the lights? It just illuminates the skies. They say one of the greatest cities to fly into is Quito, Ecuador, because it literally is built up on a hill. And they say that you can go a distance of about 100 kilometers and still see the lights of Quito, Ecuador. So the idea is that we are to be visible, that we are to illuminate those around us. I'm excited because after many, many years of having a dark living room, Heather went out and purchased 3 lamps. I am so excited. Now I can actually read without having to squint my eyes. But could you imagine me taking these 3 lamps, because I love light, and putting them all together, kind of in a cluster, and then kind of putting a blanket over them. And I think that would really maximize my experience of light. Wow, could you think how well I could read with that kind of light? But the rest of the room is dark, and nobody else can experience that illumination. Well, that's what it's like when, as Christians, we keep the lamp hidden or a basket or a bushel over it and not allow it to be exposed, to be there for the enjoyment of everyone else. We are to illuminate our world. Is it through words? Absolutely. We can make an impact for Christ through the testimony we give about our Lord Jesus Christ, who he is and what he has done. But one of the controversial aspects, but maybe one of the most edifying aspects of this paragraph, is that Jesus says, in the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds. Now, some have said, good deeds, well, the best good deed is sharing the gospel, verbally proclaiming it. I fully agree. It's a great way of promoting the gospel. But Jesus intentionally here keys in on good deeds. And good deeds are simply acts of kindness, acts of goodness, acts of mercy. Hey, we made a decision here at the church a few years ago, and we haven't changed from it. We defined evangelism as one of our core values, and we talked about promoting the gospel through proclamation and demonstration. Spreading the gospel is show and tell. It's show and tell. It's not enough just to say, well, let's get up on a soapbox somewhere on the corner and start spewing out the gospel to everybody who comes by. There may be a bit of effectiveness to that, but Jesus says here, one of the primary ways we spread the gospel is through these good deeds. I'll give you an abbreviated history lesson when it comes to the New Testament church. They took this paragraph very seriously. They practice good deeds. Luke 6, Acts 20, Romans 12, Galatians 6 and 9 and 10, 2 Thessalonians 3, 11. I could keep going on. Hebrews 10, 24. Spur one another on towards love and good deeds. That's what I'm trying to do today, is spur you on to good deeds. In Acts chapter 6, the reason why there's deacons, well, because they needed someone to run the benevolent program. Paul in 2 Corinthians took it on himself to address the issue of a worldwide famine. Rodney Stark is a historian from Baylor University, writes excellent stuff, and in a book entitled The History of Christianity, someone has critiqued it and said this about Stark. Stark was puzzled at how a marginalized, persecuted, often uneducated group of people were able not only to survive but thrive. He concludes that a key reason was their willingness to sacrifice themselves out of love for each other and for the world. This sacrifice released an explosion of light and heat that the world has ever known. Wow! An explosion of light. The heat of the gospel through good deeds. Why I disagree with my cousin in that post he sent me is hospitals originated with the early Christians. Orphanages originated with the early Christians. So many other examples of social justice owe their origin to the Christian church, and the Christian church expanded. It grew. It had worldwide impact. Part of the reason you're here today, that I'm here today, is that these were people who took the metaphor seriously. You are the salt. You are the light of the world. So in conclusion, you are salt. Enhance what is good. You say, I've got a good school. I'm in a good job. I live in a good neighborhood. Well, make sure you're enhancing it. Make sure you say, Lord, as I pursue the Beatitudes, as I become more and more like Christ, give me opportunities to enhance the good that is around us. And Lord, you know we live in a dark world. There's a lot of decay. There's a lot of moral depravity. Help me to halt that which is bad. It might be a small thing, but give me the courage to stand up for what is right and to halt what is bad. And help me in my way to be able to support those Christians and partner with those organizations that are doing great work in halting what is evil in this world. And as a church, may we have a reputation of being a church that enhances what is good and halts what is bad. And then this notion of being light. Are we a lighthouse to this neighborhood? Are you a lighthouse to your neighborhood? Are you regarded as a light in the dark place where you work or the school you teach at or attend? May we take seriously this challenge to be lights of the world. Someone has said the church of the 21st century must shift its focus from an institutional orientation to a community orientation if it is to survive and thrive. That's a jolt. Jesus doesn't want us just to exist for ourselves. We are not to be a Christian club where our purpose is to keep everybody happy. Jesus says, you are salt to the earth, that is, to everyone around us. You are to be a light to the world. So as we close, I'm going to ask you to, if you would like, just to bow your head. And I'm just going to have a challenge for you before we have our last song of benediction. I've said good deeds are acts of love, kindness, and mercy. Ask the Lord to help you identify a need. Maybe it's a neighbor that you're saying, you know what, I need to rub shoulders with that guy more. Some of you are in workplaces where it's very challenging. It's hard to live out the Christian faith. You say, Lord, give me an opportunity. Maybe it's talking with a colleague. Maybe it's encouraging someone who's going through a rough time, but give me an opportunity for an act of love and kindness. And Josh is going to come during our annual meeting and talk a little bit about community outreach. I've read the paragraph likely 60 or 70 times in the last couple of weeks. It doesn't say, Josh Kennedy, you are the salt of the earth. Josh Kennedy, you are the light of the world. All of us. You is inclusive. It's all of us. We have a responsibility in this area. So identify and then ask the Lord to give you the power to do it. To say, Lord, help me to step out and have something that I can do even this week. And then next Sunday, we'll have a little bit of accountability. Not to put anybody on the spot, but most of us don't function well unless there's some sense of accountability. Doesn't have to be a major league big thing, but it's ridiculous to say, yeah, I agree with that. I agree with the salt and light metaphor, but I'm really not prepared to do anything about it. So allow the Holy Spirit within you to move you and just spend a couple of minutes in reflection and then we will move on. You can't be salty if you're not pursuing the Beatitudes and living day by day in a Christ-like way. You can't share light. You can't spread light if the light of Christ doesn't indwell you and empower you. And the best way we make that happen is every day, day by day. Reaching out is not something we do as a project. It really is a lifestyle. And it will flow out of that right relationship with the Lord. So, Rick, will you lead us in our final song?
Please stand with us. say, Lord, it's you who gave me life, and I can't explain just how much you mean to me now that you have saved me, Lord. I give all that I am to you, that every day I can be a light that shines your name. Every day I can be a light unto the world. Every day.